This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Jeffrey Ash. Jeff is a research fellow at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University and a fellow at the Carsey Institute at the University of New Hampshire. He also teaches microfinance at Brandeis and Columbia Universities and was previously director of community finance at Oxfam America. Jeffrey Ash is here today to tell us about his book, In Their Own Hands, How Savings Groups Are Revolutionizing Development, published in 2014 and co-authored with Kyla Jagger-Nealon. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you from traditional microfinance to focusing on savings groups as a development tool?
Well, I've been one of the pioneers of microfinance going all the way back to 1979 and have been promoting microfinance in some 30 countries. But the big question was, why aren't we reaching the poor? Why are 80% still left out? And I was pursuing this question and found an answer in a program in Nepal, the Women's Empowerment Program, which I evaluated. So that was my beginning of taking a completely different path towards microfinance.
What is your critique of traditional microfinance?
Traditional microfinance has an important role, but it functions well in countries like Bangladesh and Indonesia, where the population density is very high, or in more urban areas, and with those who are just slightly better off. But it's still the rural poor, and the poorest within cities are completely left out, because there's no way that even the most innovative microlender can make money on 25 cents a week savings deposits and loans of 5, 10, 20, almost always less than $100. So this is why you need to turn the paradigm upside down and have people start saving their own money and making loans to themselves through a simple system that we have developed.
What are savings groups and how are they organized?
Well, a savings group is generally 20 people come together, most all of them women, and after they receive some simple training from a local NGO, they begin saving money, and once they accumulate a few dollars, they start loaning out this money to the members as they need it. And at the end of the year, and this happens mainly in the villages, as the granaries are empty and they've just planted and they're waiting for the harvest, they get back all their savings plus the interest on the loans they've given out all the years. And this gives them a lump sum of money so that they can survive through the lean season as they wait for the harvest.
Could you underscore how the savings groups are different from traditional microfinance?
I'd like to use a computer analogy. A microfinance program, like a bank, is a smart center, dumb edges model. And this is the opposite. All savings group programs do is introduce a simple way of organizing groups of 20, and all of the smart work, all the smart work of forming the groups, saving money, making loans, holding each other accountable, and dividing up the fund at the end is accomplished by the groups themselves. So the traditional model is to create a large institution. And then let me just tell you the difference and how much less expensive this is. For a microfinance institution, generally there is one staff person for every 250 borrowers. With this model, the savings group model, since the only job of the outsider is to train and then get out of the way, the ratio of staff to group members is 1 to 2,000. It's 10 times more cost-effective and staff-effective compared to microfinance. And once the groups are trained, then the groups operate on their own. And throughout the world, there are probably nearly 500,000 savings groups, most of which are operating without any kind of staff intervention at all.
In which countries are savings groups currently operating?
Well, they're operating in some 65 countries, but of the 10 million villagers who are part of savings groups, 9 million are in Africa. And some countries like Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda have nearly a million savings group members. And then where I work intensively, in Mali, there's 750,000. These programs dwarf microfinance in their outreach and also are reaching a population that's far poorer and far more rural than microfinance has been able to achieve.
How quickly have the groups grown?
Well, this is a very interesting story. The first saving group was created in a remote corner of Niger in 1991. And up to 2008, there were only 1 million members of savings groups. But there's been a huge growth since 2008 up to now, where the number has grown from 1 million up to 10 million. And this, in part, is due to a major infusion of money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that helped move this obscure movement up to the development mainstream today.
Would you say more about the ways in which savings groups have been built up from what was there already?
Well, in many countries, there's a tradition called, it goes by many names, it's known generically as a revolving savings and credit association. And let's say if you were from Mexico, that would be called a tanda, or in West Africa, a susu, or a tontín, or a money-go-round. And in these, a group of people come together, and they agree on a certain amount of money they'll contribute, let's say every 2 weeks, every month. And in turn, each member of the group gets the entire amount collected. So in other words, if there's 10 people and all of them are collecting a dollar every 2 weeks, one person will get $10 and the next person will get $10 until the circle is completed. So this builds on this already existing tradition of community-based savings and also holding each other accountable, which is already common in villages.
What are the advantages of saving before you borrow?
We can see this in our own life. When you're in debt, under stress all the time, how are you going to pay this back? But if you have a cushion of savings and can draw on that savings, on your own savings to take out a loan, then it's much less stressful. Also, it turns out that with a discipline of saving in a group, you can use your money much more wisely and don't get into debt. So those who are part of these groups are able to get the money that would be spent, a penny here, a dime here, a nickel there, and be able to pool it into a large enough amount to take care of a basic need. And the biggest need at the end of the year, as I was saying before, is having that lump of money so they can buy food and seeds to survive between the planting season, what they call the lean season, and with good reason, because they cut back on what they eat to maybe one meal a day during this period and have enough to eat and to plant as well.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jeffrey Ash, co-author with Kyla Jagger-Nealon of the book In Their Own Hands, How Savings Groups Are Revolutionizing Development. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the principles needed to ensure the success of savings groups?
What's been developed over the years is a simple methodology, a simple approach for training groups step by step so that they're transparent and so that they work well and so that all of the members understand the bylaws. And this training typically occurs over a six-week period with a weekly meeting, another part of the methodology. Then there's follow-up. After the 6 weeks or so, then there's a follow-up. There's meeting for another couple of months every week. And then every 2 weeks, then every month, then every 3 months, and every 6 months, and then the groups are totally on their own. But the really fascinating thing about this methodology, what made it so appealing to me when I saw this first in Nepal and then India and Zimbabwe, before I established Saving for Change through Oxfam America and Freedom from Hunger, was to see that the groups replicate themselves. This is a virally self-replicating model. So once you salt the idea with a single group in one village, then volunteers, people on their own who are members of the groups, are so excited about what they've accomplished and so excited about the fact that they now have money in hand to take care of their needs that they on their own go out and form new groups within their own village and also in neighboring villages. So this entire approach is extraordinarily cost-effective. I estimate that it costs about $1 per villager. So if you have a village of 1,000 people, it'll cost about $1,000 to introduce 2 to 5 to 10 different savings groups in this village. And according to a major random control trial study carried out through funding with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we found that there was a reduction in chronic hunger, a building in assets, mainly in the form of animals, more savings, reaching the absolute poorest, and also, as I mentioned before, this process of viral replication where the groups starting in one area will start moving on their own accord and be replicated in neighboring villages.
What happens in a typical savings group meeting? What's it like for the person who first attends?
It's a very interesting ritual that's gone through. First, the women usually come together, and they're often sitting in underneath a tree. And then one of the officers is the box keeper, and this is a person who keeps the money and the records of the group in a locked box, and she brings the box to the meeting. And then a key keeper, one person who holds the key to the box, opens the box, and then the money is counted. And the first thing to check is to be sure that the amount of money in the box, as when the box is open, is exactly the same as when the box is closed the week before. And with this model, there's usually weekly meetings. And then, once the box is open, the group recites their bylaws in unison so that everybody understands the rules of the game about saving, about borrowing, about holding each other accountable, about when they meet, and when they're going to divide the fund. And then at that point, the meeting is open, and the women, one by one, save an agreed-upon amount. And let's say that they all agree that they'll save 25 cents a week. But there's some flexibility. So it could be that one person will agree at the beginning of the cycle that they will save $1 a week. And then when the fund is divided, they'll get four times as much money. So anyway, first of all, the savings occurs, and then those who have outstanding loans will pay the interest on their loans. Those who will repay their loans in entirety. So with the, what was in the box before, plus the savings, plus the interest payments, plus the canceled loans, that whole amount is counted up again. And then the next part of the meeting is who wants a loan. One woman will put a sandal out in front or raise her hand, and they'll present their proposals for a loan. I want to buy a goat to fatten. I want to stock a store. I want to go buy some more dried fish for my trading business in the market. And these proposals were reviewed. And also there's an emergency fund. As the women save, they also put aside a little bit of money in an emergency fund. And if someone is sick, they can get an interest-free loan or sometimes even a small gift so they can buy medicine. So in this way, the group is like a virtual insurance, not only saving and borrowing, but it's the solidarity, growing solidarity between the members that enables them to deal with emergencies.
What size are the loans?
Well, the loans vary in size. In the rural areas, I've seen loans of $2, $3, $5, usually almost always under $100. But in more urban areas where there's a lot of trading, I've seen loans of $100, $200, several hundred dollars go out using exactly the same methodology. So this approach is appropriate for the poorest living in the most remote villages, and also at the same time, people who are better off traders in the markets. The great advantage is that all the profits from lending go back into the pockets of the members, and so none of it is siphoned off to pay the operating costs of a financial institution or for the profits of a larger financial institution. So this is a much better deal financially than working certainly through money lenders and even through financial institutions. As one woman said to me, why pay them when we can pay ourselves? And that sums up their feeling about this.
What are some individual success stories of saving group members?
Let me just give you one of the examples from a book. I think one of the most interesting examples actually happened in Guatemala, where I took the methodology. First, we initially went to Mali, then to Senegal, then Cambodia, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And one of the most interesting stories I heard from Guatemala was that the women in the savings groups had organized themselves so that they developed a slate of candidates. And for the first time in this part of Guatemala, women were elected as the mayors of many villages. So you could see that what was started out as a better way to save and to borrow was translated into political power. We've also seen in El Salvador, where we did this program, that those who were once the field staff of Saving for Change in that country now are assuming leadership roles in municipal governments. So there's a political as well as an economic dimension to this. One woman said it very well. A Malian woman said that before she started, she was only selling shoes on a very small scale and selling just a small amount of rice. And now with the money that she's been able to get through these loans and the disciplined savings, her business has increased in size 5 times. And with the profit, she was able to buy 5 goats. And these goats are, from their perspective, almost like walking ATM machines, which can be sold when cash is short, or if they're lucky, the goat will get pregnant and have kids, which will build their business. So I think overall, the most common comment I heard was that now with the safe and convenient place to save and easy access to loans, they say, quote, life is much less stressful. When they're strapped for cash, they don't have to go around begging for money from a relative who might not have it or might not give it to them, or to go to a moneylender. So this is just some of the kinds of things that happen.
What are the challenges in getting savings groups started?
Well, it's a very interesting story. And I think in an interview with one of the staff people in the program in El Salvador, I got this perspective. And she said basically the statistics, the numbers of groups, their performance does not represent even one quarter of the blood and sweat that it took to create these groups. And in every single village, whether this is in Mali or El Salvador or Guatemala or Cambodia, it takes a lot to convince the villagers to form the first group, because they've been scammed and robbed and cheated so many times through outside agents that there's a very high level of distrust. So I think that one of the greatest challenges is getting the first group formed. Once the risk takers have formed the first group and everybody is seeing if this is going to work, and then the second and third and fourth groups are much, much easier to train. And from there it spreads. So once they see how successful it is and they see that the NGO doesn't come swooping in the last minute and take their money, this model spreads quickly. The hardest is getting it started.
What is needed from the outside to help ensure savings group success?
The challenge is funding, and I was just doing some calculations on this just last night, and currently there are 10 million members of savings groups. Now, this compares to about 200 million of microfinance institutions. But what would it take to build up the number of people in savings groups to reach 100 million people? And this would require over a decade an investment equivalent to the amount of grant funding that goes to microfinance in a single year, and this spread over 10 years. And by the end of those 10 years, those groups with 100 million members, those 5 million groups, would be generating $2.5 billion in savings in their group funds, of which 600 million of this would be profits from savings that they generated themselves. So this is an incredibly cost-effective way of reaching the absolute poorest and starting an entire development process that begins with saving and lending and then easily adds on with the empowered people now with financial clout. It's easy to introduce health and agricultural programs. And as I mentioned before, a whole political dimension starts opening up as empowered villagers start taking political roles in their communities.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jeffrey Ash, co-author with Kyla Jagger-Nealon of the book In Their Own Hands, How Savings Groups Are Revolutionizing Development. You mentioned a bit about this earlier, but what are the opportunities for increasing the number of savings groups?
Well, I think this is probably the best example I could imagine of a quote, smart subsidy. Because as I mentioned before, you can introduce this model to a village of 1,000 people for $1,000. The great thing is that the methodology is very well established. So there's a clear methodology. It's extremely simple so that ordinary local NGOs can carry out the kind of training necessary. So you've got the methodology, you've got the institutional capacity. So really it's a matter of the major development agencies, the bilateral agencies, the foundations, and others, of putting enough resources behind this proven methodology to really expand this at a vast scale. Amazingly enough, it's kind of a difficult sell, and I've been surprised about this because the women mobilize their own savings. There's really not too many opportunities for outside investors that want to invest in loan funds to get their money back and make a profit. There's not enormous opportunities to grow huge institutions because the support to these groups is short-term and transitory. So it takes some real convincing to get this model understood enough so that funders really get behind it. Now, I could say that this is changing. I've been in this field for 14 years from the very beginning of it, and now I've seen in international conferences, the Microcredit Summit and others, that savings groups are really moving into the mainstream of development thinkers, and so there's almost a tipping point has been reached so that savings groups are considered as an important tool for development.
What's the evaluation of how well the savings groups have worked up to now?
Well, that's an interesting question, Diane, because the Gates Foundation, when they put money into this, they wanted to be sure that it made a difference. And so in the MOLLE program, Saving for Change program, which Oxfam America and Freedom from Hunger did jointly, the Gates Foundation did a major study, a random control trial study, in 500 villages in MOLLE. And these villages, about half of them randomly selected, received training in the Saving for Change methodology, the savings group methodology. And the rest were the control groups. And it was very interesting after 3 years to see what had happened. It is very, very costly and very, very well carried out methodology. And they found out overall that there was a decline in chronic hunger, not just for the people that joined the groups, but for the entire village. There was a building of assets, mainly in the form of more goats, more animals. It's called out there saving on the hoof. These animals can be cashed in. There was an overall increase in savings by a third. And at the same time, while the slightly better off in the village were more likely to join the groups initially, also many, many of the very, very poorest, and we're not talking about the $5 a day people, or the people living on $2 a day of highly irregular income, or even $1 a day of highly irregular income, but 50 cents or less. Those people were joining groups. These women were joining groups as well. And as I mentioned also before, there was a viral replication. They found that these ideas spread by themselves, by these empowered villagers that were so excited about what they had accomplished in their own hands by themselves, that many savings groups, Saving for Change groups, were popping up in the control villages.
What do you see for the future of savings groups? What's next?
Well, I think what's next is a lot of exciting initiatives underway. One thing is using these savings groups systematically as a platform for other development efforts. So, for example, our partner in this venture, Freedom from Hunger, is introducing a health curriculum through the groups. Now that the groups are together, they're meeting regularly, they have resources, they're empowered, their aspirations for the future have increased, now they are learning about health education. In MOLLE, we introduced a program for agriculture, a new approach for agriculture to build up the wasted soils. Then there's a whole political aspect. There's another aspect of this is methodologically that it's now possible to train groups at even less cost. The methodology has been simplified. Now there are simple apps that enable groups to keep their records electronically. Particularly Freedom from Hunger is pioneering ways of providing the training curriculum on cell phones and other electronic means. So there's a lot of breakthroughs in this methodology. Also, as institutions start seeing that it's a good investment because those villagers that they had no access to earlier now are formed in groups, and some individuals within these groups now are taking out loans as individuals from banks, and groups are storing their excess money in banks. And this becomes a path towards institutional finance as well.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like to leave a message that this is a new approach to development. We also lament about how intractable, how difficult, and the fact that hundreds of billions of dollars in development aid have been wasted on ill-conceived efforts. Now, microfinance has been one of the shining examples of what is possible to do, but I think the saving group methodology shows that the problems of reaching the very poorest with results that actually work, which are simple and easily replicable, is not as expensive or difficult as it seems. It's the real revolution. You know, I've been in this business for almost 50 years, started as a Peace Corps volunteer out in Ecuador. You know, just trying to, what works? What can really make a difference at a scale that's large enough to be important? You can always change one or two people, but or one village or another, or but how do you do this for thousands of villages or hundreds of thousands of villages and millions of people? And I think this is probably the simplest, best, and easiest way of accomplishing that that I've been able to find so far. And one other note I want to take is that in this country, I am launching a program now called Saving Work through the Carsey School of Social Policy, and we're taking the ideas developed in the developing world about disciplined savings and mutual support and are introducing these ideas to the some 34 million in our country who are unbanked and another 34 million who are underbanked. We think that this idea of disciplined savings and mutual support could have enormous impact here in the United States as well. So I'm just launching this effort now and hope to be able to report to you in a couple of years about how these ideas have been applied to the United States.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Jeff.
Well, thank you very much, Diane. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you.
You are just listening to Jeffrey Ash, co-author with Kyla Jagger-Nealon of the book In Their Own Hands, How Savings Groups Are Revolutionizing Development, published by Barrett Kohler Publishers and Oxfam America in 2014. For more information, check on the web at intheirownhands.com. Again, that's intheirownhands.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.